Shrink Wrap Radio, number 821, Isabella Clark speaking with Stoic philosopher Professor Massimo Pigliucci on the quest for good leaders. My London associate Isabella Clark once again interviews widely celebrated Stoic philosopher Professor Massimo Pigliucci about his 2022 book, The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. Isabella, or Issy, previously interviewed Professor Pigliucci on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 685, Philosopher Massimo Pigliucci, Stoicism and Coping with the COVID-19 Virus.
It's Issy Clark here. Dr. Dave has generously given me the opportunity to interview returning guest Massimo Pigliucci. Professor Pigliucci has a PhD in evolutionary biology from the University of Connecticut and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Tennessee. He currently is the K.D. Irani Professor of Philosophy at the City College of New York. His research interests include the philosophy of science, the nature of pseudoscience, and practical philosophies like Stoicism and New Skepticism. Professor Pigliucci has been elected Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science for fundamental studies of genotype by environmental interactions and for public defense of evolutionary biology from pseudoscientific attack. He is the author of 16 books, including the best-selling How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life, published by Basic Books. Other titles include Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, that's the University of Chicago Press. And the most recent is The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. And again, that's published by Basic Books. Now, here's the interview. Massimo Pigliucci, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Indeed. We spoke once before. It was episode 685, and it was right at the start of the COVID pandemic. And for those of you who want to check that one out, it's philosopher Massimo Pigliucci on Stoicism and Coping with the COVID-19 Virus. And that was on March the 21st in 2020. So we were pretty close to the beginning of it all.
Yep, right there.
But this time you've got a new book out, Quest for Character. But before we get into that, I was just wondering if you could introduce yourself again to those who maybe haven't listened to that episode, and just explain to us how you came to be writing about character, Stoicism, and having this expert view on all things Stoic.
Well, thank you. I don't know about an expert, but I'm trying. I got into Stoicism simply because at some point, like a lot of people, I went through a midlife crisis and I needed some resources to deal with that crisis. You know, nothing out of the ordinary. My father died after a long illness, and I was hit by a sudden divorce that I was not expecting, that sort of stuff. Now, I figured that philosophy might be a place to look for resources when adversity strikes, because there really are not that many options. You either go religious or you go philosophical. And since I was done with being religious since my teenage years, I grew up Catholic, but then I left the church, then I figured, okay, let's look at philosophy. And so I started taking a look at what it's called practical philosophy, or philosophy as a way of life. And there are a number of examples. You can look at Buddhism, you can read about Aristotle, you can familiarize yourself with Epicurus. And all of those were very interesting. I did all of that, but none of them really clicked. And then at one point I rediscovered really Stoicism, because I read some of the Stoics when I was much younger, but I rediscovered Stoicism, particularly a guy named Epictetus, who was an early second century Stoic. He started out his life literally at the bottom of the societal rank. He was a slave, and then eventually he was freed and he established his own school and became one of the most sought after teachers of in the entire Mediterranean area. And Epictetus immediately spoke to me. It was like one of those things, like, okay, this guy makes sense. He's speaking plainly and clearly. He has a sense of humor bordering on sarcasm, which I appreciated. And so I was hooked. And once I got to Stoicism through Epictetus, then, of course, little by little, I sort of started reading all the other ones, Marcus Aurelius and his Meditations. Seneca is arguably the most important Stoic writer. He certainly the one from whom we have the most extant writings. And so, years passed, and here we are.
And here we are with this new book. So you've written books that are about people's dealing with particular or dealing with their own self-development, and books that are about the tradition in general. But this one is very different. And you mentioned there Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, who particularly come into this one rather more than Epictetus, I think. So could you just tell us a little bit about Quest for Character?
Yeah, The Quest for Character, which in the UK I think is published as How to Be Good. I don't know why publishers changed the titles of the books or and the, their covers, but whatever, that's their business. Started out because I was actually interested in a particular story, which gives the subtitle to the book, the story of Socrates and Alcibiades. So Socrates, of course, needs no introduction, arguably the most famous philosopher of all time in the Western tradition. However, Alcibiades is one of those characters that are so fascinating and yet not well known. And I still wonder why nobody's actually made a movie out of his life. I mean, this guy was incredible, right? He was impossibly handsome, uber rich, very brave, dashing kind of character. This was like very ambitious. It's
And
like,
a sportsman as well, wasn't he?
and
With his,
exactly, yes. He won chariot races at the Olympics. I mean, it's like the guy was all over the place. And he also happened to be a friend and student of Socrates. And that's where the story begins to be interesting, because what happened was that a very, very young Alcibiades goes to Socrates and says, I think I have all it takes to be a leader in Athens. I want to be a statesman. This guy was in his early 20s, right? So ambitious. But I realized that, I might use some advice here. And so I come to you, my mentor, for some advice. And Socrates basically sets him down and gives him what we would today call a job interview and starts saying, so, okay, let's talk about what would you do? How would you approach problems and issues in the city? And it becomes very clear during the dialogue that Alcibiades is not really interested in improving the city or making it a better place or anything. He's interested in self-aggrandizing. He's a narcissist, right? And so at some point, Socrates says, you really shouldn't do this. In fact, I'm going to quote this striking passage. This is from the Alcibiades Minor, which is a dialogue attributed to Plato. And Socrates says, then, alas, Alcibiades, what a condition you suffer from. I hesitate to name it, but since we two are alone, it must be said. You are wedded to stupidity, best of men, of the extreme sort, as the argument accuses you and you accuse yourself. So this is why you are leaping into the affairs of the city before you have been educated. It's like, holy crap, this is really harsh on the part of Socrates, right? It's like you suffer from stupidity, best of men. Now, the word there that is often translated as stupidity is amatia, which in Greek actually means something closer to unwisdom. So what Socrates is saying is that Alcibiades can have all of the other stuff that normally people, are impressed by, looks and wealth and all that sort of stuff. But he's missing the important thing, the most important thing though. He's missing a good character. He's a narcissist, he's not really into helping other people. And so he shouldn't get into politics. Now, unfortunately, Alcibiades does not follow Socrates' advice. And sure enough, it becomes a disaster. I mean, Alcibiades arguably was half responsible for the disaster that was the Peloponnesian War for Athens. So this is an extraordinary story. And when I started reading about this, not only I was fascinated by the life and character of Alcibiades, but I thought, isn't that interesting that Socrates is now in the business of advising people, essentially giving career advice to people, whether to do or not do certain things, particularly in the politics. And it turns out, when I looked into it a little bit more in detail, that there are several other places where Socrates does that. You know, a lot of the times we think of Socrates as it emerges from the Platonic dialogues, because Plato is the major source that we have about Socrates, but there are others. And one of the other major sources is a book by a guy named Xenophon. And the title of the book is The Memorabilia, and it's really a story of Socrates. And Xenophon, like Plato, was a student of Socrates, but unlike Plato, Xenophon was not a philosopher, he was a general. And so he really wasn't interested that much in the philosophy. He was interested in the politics. He was interested in practical advice that that Socrates was going to give. And so Xenophon tells us of several instances where Socrates advises people either to get into politics or not to get into politics. And when people follow his advice, things actually go well. So there is one case, you know. So there is one case of Glaucon, for instance, who was Plato's brother. Clearly not a good fit for politics, for statesmanship. Socrates tells him so, and Glaucon actually, unlike Alcibiades, Glaucon actually follows Socrates' advice, becomes a musician, and everything is fine. On the other hand, Charmides, who was Glaucon's own son, was not into going into politics. He didn't want to get into politics. He was shy. But Socrates thought that this guy really had what it takes in terms of character. And so he actually said, "You really should get into politics. You really should try to be helpful to the city." And in fact, Charmides does. And unfortunately, he does under very dire circumstances for Athens, because by that point, the city had lost the Peloponnesian War, but nevertheless, he does his best. So it turns out that what emerges is this figure of Socrates, not the gadfly that asks embarrassing questions to powerful people, as we get in Plato, but the person actually gives advice on career, and particularly in politics. And so he influences the politics of the city, essentially by going around and telling people, yeah, you should do it, or no, you shouldn't do it.
And so what he's determining that on is on the person's intrinsic character.
Correct. He's looking at character, he's looking at virtue. Now, the problem nowadays when we talk about virtue is that people tend to think of virtue in the sort of the way in which the Christian tradition does. So things like charity and hope and chastity, you know, that sort of stuff. But in fact, what we're talking about is virtue in the Greco-Roman sense of the word. The original word is arete, and arete just means excellence. So to be virtuous means to be an excellent human being, the best human being you can be. Now, according to the Greeks, it's not just human beings that can be excellent. Anything can be excellent. For instance, the other day with my wife, we went and bought a new bread knife. And it is an excellent
Oh,
bread
bread
knife,
knife is
right?
a knife is one of the Aristotelian examples, isn't it, in the
Exactly, it
Nicomachean
is.
Ethics? That's perfect.
It is. And so this one is a knife which is clearly endowed with arete. It's an excellent knife. It cuts the bread in an incredibly nice way, right? So now, why would you say something like that of a knife? Because the knife has a function. As Aristotle will say, right? The function of a bread knife is to cut bread. So if the knife does its fun carries out its function well, then it's an excellent knife. Now, and the question is, well, what is the function of a human being? You know, how can you talk about excellence in a human being in a similar fashion? And here, the Greco-Romans, by and large, agreed. The Stoics, in particular, sort of articulated this notion that what really characterizes human beings by nature are two things. One, the fact that we're so smart. We're rational animals. Or at least potentially rational animals. We can use our brain to solve our problems, right? Unlike other animals, we don't have strong muscles, big jaws, or you know, we don't fly. We don't do any of that stuff. What we do is we think about stuff, and we solve our problems that way. So that's number one. And then the second thing that characterizes humanity is the fact that we are highly social. Right? We are. I mean, there are other social animals for sure, but our society, human societies, are much more structured, much more complex than anything else,
And much bigger in terms
and
of
much
the, in
bigger.
terms of the, yeah.
So it follows, therefore, that a excellent human being is a human being that uses those two characteristics of our species to the best possible in the best possible way. So somebody who reasons very well and who is cooperative, pro-social toward other human beings, that's an excellent human being. And that's what it means to be virtuous in that sense.
And this is where, I mean, we will, for those watchers and listeners who are thinking, well, wait a second, where's the psychology coming in? That will be coming in shortly. There were just a couple of things I wanted to bring up before we sort of head towards that. One is, I don't know if you've read it, but Mary Reno wrote a book. I think it's called The End of the Wine or something like that, which is about Alcibiades. So
Ah,
there
nice.
is, yes. And that's upon that, my knowledge of Alcibiades rests. But I just wanted to mention it. And one other thing, you know, during in the course of the book, you go through the process of looking at the Socrates' relationship with Alcibiades, as well as Aristotle with Alexander the Great. And we don't want to give away everything for all the people who are going to go out and buy it. But there are those various case studies. Plato also with Dionysius of
Yeah, that's a story
wine.
that it's not well known, right? But
No, I hadn't heard that.
Plato, we typically people look at Plato's dialogues, the Republic, etc., the Apology, and so on. But Plato wrote other things. In particular, he wrote several letters to some of his friends, and one of these letters recounts his experiences with Dionysius II of Syracuse. And basically, Plato was invited by a student of his, Dion, to Syracuse to try to see if he could actually put into practice his political theories by teaching virtue and by teaching politics to Dionysius II. And you have to give it to Plato. He was in his 60s when he did that.
So
So
how
he got.
far do you know how far it would have been for, you know, him to have
It would have
traveled?
been several weeks of travel,
Wow.
most of which would have been at sea. And at the time, traveling by sea, the Mediterranean wasn't exactly an easy thing. So this guy in his 60s, and then he does it again later on, 10 years later. So he was in his early 70s. He takes the boat and goes to Syracuse and tries to put into practice his ideas. However, unfortunately, it turned out into a disaster because Dionysius II was really not interested in virtue and politics, in good politics. He was interested in pleasure and debauchery, essentially. And Plato almost lost his life. I mean, Plato almost got killed as a result of this attempt. So yeah, that part of the book goes through a number of examples, some in which a philosopher tries to influence a statesman, a politician, for the best. And so those are cases like Plato and Dionysus, Socrates and various people, Aristotle and Alexander the Great, Seneca and Nero, for instance. And then, however, I also go immediately after that, I take a look at a number of cases where the statesmen themselves, the politician themselves, actually are into philosophy. Now, philosophy, of course, here we need to make clear that I don't mean, when I say a philosopher, I don't mean somebody with a PhD who works at a university and writes very abstruse things that only a few dozen people in the world are going to read. That, in other words, not somebody like myself.
Because you
But
are a philosopher of science, aren't you,
that's
by
right. I'm
frame?
a
Yeah.
philosopher of science, so I do that kind of thing. What I mean is a philosopher in the ancient Greco-Roman sense of the term, meaning somebody who tries to live philosophically, who tries to actually enact principles, ethical principles in their lives. In that sense, anybody can be a philosopher. In fact, arguably, by the end of the book, I try to make the case that everybody ought to be a philosopher in that sense. That we all should, in fact, live an ethical life as much as we can. So it turns out that cases where the statesman himself is a philosopher in this particular sense, they go better. That's Marcus Aurelius, so they're more successful. That's things like Marcus Aurelius, for instance, Julian the Apostate, who was the last pagan Roman emperor, and there are a number of examples. Cato the Younger, who was a Stoic during the Roman Republic, Cicero, who was also a Stoic during the Roman Republic. Well, he was Stoic informed. Or we would say today, Stoic curious.
Yes, you describe him as rather more pragmatic, whereas Cato's more of a sort of idea, not an idealist. I don't know how you'd put the distinction.
Yeah, a little bit more rigid. So that's the problem. That so, the question is not just that one needs a good character and one needs to, operate on the basis of principle, ethical principles, et cetera. But one also needs, if we're talking about a politician, one also needs to be flexible, right? So the Socratic view of politics is that politics ought to be informed by ethics. In fact, guided by ethics, right? That if you're unethical, then you really should not be in the business of politics because you're going to make a disaster out of things. You're going to become Alcibiades, basically. However, the opposite extreme, there is an opposite view, which I do discuss in the book, and that's Machiavelli. So
Yes.
Machiavelli says, no, forget about virtue. It's quite the opposite. If you want to be an effective politician, effective statesman, you really need to do away with ethics at all. It's in the, don't even bother doing that because otherwise ethics gets in the way. And Machiavelli is the first modern, somewhat modern, he was, of course, back in the Renaissance, writer who defended what we today call realpolitik, right? So the political realism. Now, the problem with realpolitik, however, is that the kind of character that actually try to implement realpolitik are not the kind of characters that I would like to go and have dinner with, like Mao Zedong, for instance, or Henry Kissinger, or people like that. It's like, hold on a sec. So there must be something in between. And the something in between, actually, I think, is arguably best exemplified by Cicero. So Cicero was a politician, a public advocate, so he was a lawyer, and a philosopher. He was absolutely convinced with Socrates, he agreed with Socrates that ethics are to rule not only politics in particular, but life in general. That is, you shouldn't really live a life that is not informed by your ethics. He wrote an entire book called On Duty, where he tries to demonstrate that actually doing the right thing is also it's equivalent to doing what is best for you, that what is best for you is always the right thing. It's always the ethical thing to do. However, because he was an actual politician and a lawyer, he was also very aware that the kind of rigidity that he saw in Cato was not helpful, that it's good to have principles, but it's also good to remember that you need to deal with other people, and that means compromise, that the name of the game in politics is compromise. So let me quote you this thing because it is one of my favorite in the book. At one point, Cicero is frustrated apparently with Cato, and he writes a letter to his lifelong friend Atticus, where he says, "As for our friend Cato, you do not love him more than I do. But after all, with the very best intentions and the most absolute honesty, he sometimes does harm to the Republic. He speaks and votes as though he were in the Republic of Plato, not in the scum of Romulus." Right? I love this image that, we don't live in Plato's Republic. We don't live in utopia. We cannot
Yes.
afford to always be inflexible. We live in the scum of Romulus. Romulus, of course, was the founder of Rome, right? And so we live in a situation where you need to do what you can, and not always. That doesn't mean always what you would want to do. And that, I think, at the end of the day, is really the key. That is, Cicero's attitude is really the key to a good statesmanship. A combination of you act on the basis of principles, you don't go Machiavelli, but at the same time you realize that you will probably need to compromise and that you might never reach the ultimate goal, but you might try to get as close as possible, as close as the actual situation on the ground allows you.
Now, there's two ways to go from here, and I think in a moment it will be good to talk about an issue that you brought up there with Cicero about the idea that doing your duty also turns out to be what's good for you, and to discuss that a bit because that takes us into psychology to an extent. But
Yes.
another thing I was reading, I've been reading a book by Gabor Mate and his son Daniel Mate. The Myth of the Normal, and actually, I've been listening to it on Audible. And as I was going through it, there was a chapter on leadership, and he said I jotted it down because I thought it might be interesting to you. And he says the traumatized or wounded elect the traumatized and wounded. So he's talking about the way that in so much of the particularly our rich Western nations, that the myth of the normal is that it's normal to be a complete individualist. It's normal to have these stressful lives. It's normal to look at this amount of inequality, and that where all of that's normalized, you have people who are traumatized and wounded. And he quoted some research by someone Milburn, whose research suggested that the more adverse childhood, something like violence, but it didn't need to be actual physical violence, was suffered by an individual, the greater their inclination to support things like the death penalty or particularly authoritarian leaders, unless the individual had psychotherapy. And so Gabalmato was talking to the researcher, and he said, "What's the difference if they've had psychotherapy?" And he said, "An individual who has had psychotherapy is an individual who's willing to be wrong, and someone whose character and it allows them to be wrong and to learn and to recognize that they have made mistakes rather than that mistakes were made and not by me, is someone who has the sort of, one, at least one of the elements of character that they can sort of overcome." But I just thought it was very interesting that the connection, the strong connection really between our psychological health and our character, and maybe political choices and what kind of politics we might go for.
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, Socrates was the first one to put forth a no the notion that a good life, what the Greeks called the eudaimonic life, a eudaimonia is a good life, right? A life of flourishing is the result of a psychological balance in your soul, right? It's your which of course, he was talking about soul, we talk about mind, but there's really not that much of a difference for practical purposes. So the idea is that a psychologically well-adjusted human being is a happy human being. And in fact, that transcends even the external circumstances. That is, of course, external circumstances may be more or less desirable, right? If you It's certainly better to be wealthy than to be poor. It's certainly better, as the Stoics would put it, it's certainly better to be educated than not, and better to be healthy than sick, et cetera, et cetera. But as it turns out, in fact, both the Stoics and modern research in psychology shows that external circumstances affect us much less than we think. Yeah, there are plenty of examples when, a lot of people, for instance, think that, oh, if I only, won the lottery, let's say, and made a bunch of money, I would be much happier. And it turns out that's just not true. What happens is people do win the lottery, and their sort of subjective happiness goes up for a little bit. The exhilaration of the new situation, all that, and that lasts days or weeks, sometimes months. And then after that, they go back to whatever level they had before. If they were unhappy, they're going to be millionaires, but unhappy. And if they were happy, it doesn't matter that they have millions now. They're pretty much where they were before. So happiness sometimes is, it's one way to put it is it's an inside job, meaning that it comes from the inside. It doesn't really rely on external circumstances, of course, up to a point, right? I mean, if the external circumstances are really dire, it's imagined for somebody to be happy. But we're far more independent of external circumstances than we realize. That said, we live in a society that tries to convince us of the opposite, right? We're bombarded. We live in a highly consumeristic society where we're bombarded by images of, if only you have the latest iPhone, or if only you have the larger car, or if only you have the bigger house, and all, then you'll be happy, then you'll be perfectly fine. And that's simply not true. It's the kind of lie that, of course, makes the pockets of people at Apple or Ford Motor Company, et cetera, much and much larger. But no, it doesn't make us any happier.
No, it's interesting though, I mean, that we are that this level of independence, but at the same time there is this sort of communal essence that I think your book stresses as well. So although we might be external circumstances might have less impact on us, there is the suggestion that the health of a society that we're in
And you know, the health psychologists are very aware of the health of the family structure in which we rise through, also makes an impact. And it's for that reason that I think these kind of pro-social aspects that come through in Stoic philosophy are so important, and particularly when we look at leaders. And I just thought it would be useful here if you would list some of those traits that that you sort of slaved through the book and through the work that you've done are the most important character traits before we sort of turn this more towards psychology.
First of all, yes, I do agree that a social connections, social cooperation, relationships, those are crucial. That was realized, of course, by the Greco-Romans, not just the Stoics, but for instance, the Epicureans, for one thing. And it certainly is exactly what modern science tells us. And again, it goes back to those two characteristics that set aside the human species, right? Rationality, or at least the ability to be rational, and the high degree of sociality. You know, we can survive on our own for sure under certain circumstances, but we don't thrive unless we are in a social group, unless we are, you know, in contact with others. There is another nice bit from Cicero, who says, you know, even if you could ascend to the heavens and look at planets and stars, you would not, that experience, as beautiful and as transcending as it is, it would not be meaningful unless you can share with somebody. Right? So yeah, this notion that it is in large part about society. It's both the ancient idea as well as the what comes out of modern science. In terms of the character traits, so depending on who you ask of the Greco-Romans, you get a different list. Aristotle, who was very much into, you know, classification and taxonomy, he actually listed, I think, 12 different virtues or something like that. But the fundamental ones are four, and they are referred to often as the cardinal virtues. And these are practical wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. Interestingly, these are actually first listed by Plato in the Republic. That's the earliest that we find them. Of course, they were probably well known before, but it's the first time we get them in writing. Then they were adopted by the Stoics. And in fact, later on, much later on, they were also incorporated into the Christian notion of virtue, because Thomas Aquinas lists seven Christian virtues, and these seven are practical wisdom, courage, justice, temperance, hope, faith, and charity. So he just added the last three to the four classical ones. So what are these? These are You can think of the cardinal virtues as essentially providing us with a moral compass. That anything, the idea is that anything you do, you should ask yourself, well, is this wise? Is it courageous? Is it wise? Is it just? And is it temperate? And if the answer is yes to all of them, then do it. If the answer is not, then don't do it. It's essentially that's the way it works. Now, practical wisdom, it's a kind of a funny concept, because where many people might be familiar with the general notion of wisdom, you know, people allegedly get wiser when they get older, but
Oh, I
practical
definitely
wisdom,
have got so much wiser.
right? Exactly. But practical wisdom is kind of a, you know, what do you mean by practical? The word there in Greek is phronesis, and it was translated by Cicero in Latin as prudentia, so prudence. But prudence in modern English has kind of changed its meaning a little bit. To be prudent today just means to, you know, be careful, be cautious about things. While on the other hand, in even if you go back by a century and a half only, in English, prudence meant the ability to navigate complex situations in the best way possible. So that is what practical wisdom is. It's the knowledge of what is really good for you and not good for you, and how to steer your way through life in a way that is, in fact, the best. Courage, we often think of courage as, you know, oh, going to battle, or, you know, physical courage. But that's really not what it is about. Courage is moral courage. It's the courage to do the right thing, even though it may cost you. Justice is the notion of treating other people with respect and dignity and fairness, pretty much the way in which you would want to be treated by them. And then finally, temperance is the idea that you should try to do things in right measure, neither too much nor too little. So let me give you an example. For instance, let's say that tomorrow I go back to work and I see my, I enter into the office and I see my boss harassing a coworker, which he would never do because he's a really nice guy. But nevertheless, let's imagine for a minute that he will. So what am I supposed to do? I'm witnessing this scene. Should I intervene, and how should I intervene, or should I just mind my own business? You know, walk out. What should I do? So I asked myself the question in terms of the four cardinal virtues. In terms of practical wisdom, to intervene in a situation where you can help another human being is a good thing because it's actually good for your own character. And it improves yourself. You're improving yourself if you are helpful to others. Why? Because cooperating and working with other people is actually a fundamental aspect of human nature. So you're actually becoming more excellent, right, by doing that. So the first answer is, yeah, it seems to be like in terms of practical wisdom, I should intervene. Courage. Well, it will take courage to intervene because it's my boss, mm-hmm. right? So there could be repercussions. I could get fired. That's unlikely since I have tenure. But, there could be repercussions. You know, there could be some kind of punishment or some kind of, you know, nasty behavior later on. So, but if it is the right thing to do, I really ought to have the courage to do it. Justice. Well, justice, as I said, is to treat other people fairly and in the way in which you would like to be treated. Well, I would certainly like it if I were the one to be being harassed, that somebody else would step in and try to be helpful in the situation. So there's three yes already. What about temperance? Well, temperance tells me how to intervene.
Right.
Right. So because I could do too much. So I could jump into the situation and start punching my boss on the nose. It's like, well, but that's not called for because it's not a violent situation. There's no physical danger here. So there is no reason to go that far. At the opposite extreme, I could do too little. I could just mumble something under my breath without anybody hearing me and then say to myself, hey, I said something. So, you know, and that's it. Clearly, I don't want to do any one of those two things. I want to steer a middle course. Temperance tells me, no, you need to step in clearly so that you're heard, but also calmly so that you're going to diffuse the situation and not further, you know, make things worse compared to what they are. So that's just one example.
No, I think it's a great example. And the other thing that comes to me when you were going through that example was putting myself in that situation. You're going to feel an awful lot better about yourself if that's what you've done. And mm-hmm. And this is where we can sort of look at the psychological impact on it, because when we had an email exchange before, I was suggesting to you that it seems that the work that comes through the philosophy of life, if you like, or the philosophy that helps to guide our life, is in a way offering an expanded view of the idea of psychological health. So if we consider, you know, you can consider mental well-being very, very narrowly as, you know, the absence of a mental illness, or you can look at mental wellness more like a positive psychology mode as, oh, I'm perfectly happy. Or you can expand it that bit further and say, okay, I'm coping well with life. I feel pretty content, but also I'm a good part of this whole structure that is society. And it seems to me that the kind of view that came through your book did seem to suggest that an idea of that mental wholeness is something that does incorporate the way we treat others, the way that we behave in the world, not just something that's stuck in this sort of box of bone.
That's exactly right. In fact, when I mentioned Cicero's On Duty,
yes.
On Duties, that's where he articulates this view. He says, look, sometimes people seem to think that what is good for them is not necessarily the virtuous thing. In fact, often they even suggest that doing the virtuous thing is at odds with doing the right thing. And he tries to show that that is not the case. And the reason it's not the case is precisely what you just said. That is, we have a conscience. We have, you know, we have to live with what we do. So for instance, let's say I file my taxes and I cheat And I'm tempted to cheat because that's good. That's better for me, right? I get more money for myself and less to the government. Right. But it's also not right, because I am cheating not just the government, I'm cheating everybody else in the country because they're paying their share of taxes and I'm not. So that would seem to be like a situation where on the surface, it's obvious that not doing the right thing is advantageous. But then I have to live with not doing the right thing, right? Then I have to live with my conscience would say, oh, I cheated. I have an advantage here. I have more money in my bank, but that's because I cheated. And so now I start feeling bad about things. And that's why Cicero says that's the obvious mark of the fact that the two things, doing the right, what is right, and doing what is good for you, are actually in synchrony. They're not opposed because it's a question of your psychological well-being. Now, of course, this doesn't apply to some of us. If you're a psychopath, you probably don't suffer from a heavy conscience, but most people do. And the reason most people do is not just because we try to instill that kind of sentiment in people as they grow up, right? I mean, my parents, my grandparents tried to instill in me this notion that you need to do the right thing. So there is certainly some cultural conditioning during our upbringing. But the Greco-Romans would say it's also in the nature of humanity. It's instinctive to feel bad when you do something bad, something that undermines your connections with other people. And modern primatologists agree because they find that the kind of behavior that we think of as collaborative, pro-social, fair, et cetera, it's not found just in human beings. It's found also in other social primates. Now, of course, they don't do it because they think about stuff. At least we think they don't think about stuff. We don't know for sure. In that case, in the case of other social primates, that behavior is instinctive. In the case of human beings, it's both. We have an instinct. As we grow up, as we're very little, we start immediately. When we're infants, we start immediately
Well,
making
like that
connections.
research with babies as well,
Exactly.
that they will be more keen on the doll that's been helpful in a mind test. I'm
Correct.
sure most of our listeners will be familiar with those
Correct.
examples.
So developmental psychologists show that, yeah, that is in fact the case. We have a pro-social instinct. Now, the Greco-Romans, both Seneca and Cicero, for instance, tell us that nature provides us with the basics of virtue, with the beginnings of virtue, and then it's up to our reasoning ability to expand it. So what does that mean, for instance? Here's an interesting, intriguing example that I've been sort of thinking about for some time. We are instinctively pro-social, but we're also instinctively xenophobic. That is, we have this notion that if it is somebody of our in-group that we're talking about, then yes, we should try to be helpful and collaborative and fair, et cetera, et cetera. But if it's somebody from the out-group, that's different. That could be an enemy. That could be dangerous. Now, that I would suggest that that is a result of a human evolution because, for most of human evolution, our in-group was small. It was like 60 to 80 people, 100 people, give or take, mostly relatives, uncles and aunts and things like that. And anybody that was coming from outside very likely was in fact dangerous. It was not good news. But now we live in a society, in a global society, where we're all literally on the same boat, and what happens in China or in India does influence what happens here in the United States or in Europe directly. We're no longer disconnected. We're no longer, even if we don't meet those people, what those people do affects us and vice versa. And I think that that's a good example of what Seneca and Cicero meant when they said that nature gives us the beginnings of virtue, but then it's up to our reasoning ability, which is also given to us by nature, to expand it, right? So yes, I am naturally inclined to be nice and cooperative to people that I know, toward people that I know and I have relationships with. But then my reason comes in and says, yeah, but just because somebody's on the other side of the planet, that doesn't mean that they're different. They're human beings. They want the same stuff. They fear the same things. They are the same they go after the same things. They have the same joys and sorrows, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, I ought to expand my circle of concern, not just to the people that I know, but to anybody on the planet. That means cosmopolitanism, the ancient notion of cosmopolitanism, which was introduced by the Cynic philosophers and then adopted by the Stoic, is exactly that one. We are members of a cosmopolis, a universal city of humanity, and so we ought to really help anybody who is a member of that city.
And I'd go even further and say we should help all earthlings, but
yes, in fact, some modern Stoics go that far. You know, the ancient Stoics were not particularly concerned with the environment and other animal species because, you know, they were 2,000 years ago. They didn't know a lot of stuff that we know today. But today we know that the biosphere is interconnected. And we also know that other animals suffer, you know, just like human beings. In terms of animal, you know, treating animals, I think even though I'm not a utilitarian, I think that the utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham got it right. In one point he was asked, you know, so how do we treat other animals? And he said, well, the question there is not whether they think or whether they talk. The question is whether
they suffer.
If they suffer, that's
it.
Yeah, it is very powerful.
Through the book, and you know, in line with the Stoic tradition, and also with Aristotelianism, your advice is that character is something that can be shaped, and that the shaping works through habit, through sort of working on particular practices, through trying to be what you aim towards being. And I do think that's very powerful. It gives a lot of agency. And I was thinking about that in line with psychotherapy. When I was doing a course, I was doing a module on philosophy and philosophy and psychotherapy. And one of the papers was a couple of writers who were suggesting how advantageous it would be to have psychotherapists helping people work towards not just mental health, but towards the character improvement, towards sort of self-development. Right. And interestingly, everyone else in the class thought this was sort of paternalistic and incredibly offensive and some kind of, you know, like dreadful big brother experience. And I was rather shocked because you know, it seemed to me that you know, I suppose I do have this rather holistic view of mental health as being something that's about being, you know, a good person on the outside, not just on the inside. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was a psychotherapist who worked with addicts, and he said, well, of course I had to be doing that because I had to be able to teach people coping mechanisms. I had to help people to become the best version of themselves, because otherwise, you know, they will struggle incredibly hard not to fall back into the addiction. So that had to be part of what I was doing.
Yeah.
And it does seem to me that we have this, you know, we want to separate things very firmly, and that all I'm dealing with is your illness. And once you're well, the rest of your character can go to hell or whatever. But, yeah. but to take this sort of more complete view of a person seems as if it could offer an awful lot of benefits.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I've encountered that attitude before. In fact, one of the problems in talking about character and virtue is that, at least in certain quarters, those are considered not only old-fashioned kind of concepts, but, as you just said, paternalistic, right? It's like, oh, you know, who do you think you are that you can teach other people, you know, how to live their life, essentially. And that, but think about it for a second. Well, you can accuse somebody of paternalism, but you are being incredibly arrogant and hubristic by essentially implying, I don't need to be taught anything when it comes down to living my life because I know everything, right? It's like, wait a minute, hold on. And also, what do you think parents do, right? At least ideally, our parents teach us how to literally teach us how to live life. They give us the basics of morality, of ethics, and also, you know, they instill values in us. They guide us in terms of our choices and so on and so forth. So it's like, what is that if not teaching other people how to live? When you go to a priest or a rabbi or an imam or anything like that, and you're asking for advice, what are you doing if not asking another person, you know, hey, how should I do? How should I behave under these circumstances? So I find it really peculiar that then people turn around and say, oh, no, we don't want to go to a philosopher or to a psychotherapist because, you know, that's paternalistic. It's like, wait, what?
And it's also so crazy considering that there are so many influences to influence us. I mean, using the, you know, neurologists, neuroscientists to influence sort of advertising and the addiction of games or apps or whatever. There is so much that is influencing us away from the sort of
exactly.
Temperance, certainly, and so many other aspects of life, whether it's advertising or whether it's aspects of the internet or what have you, that are working towards one way, that it seems like you pretty much have to have the other way if you're going to even strike a balance of neutrality, let alone moving towards good character.
Exactly. And now, the in my mind, this should be done particularly early on in life, because modern science tells us that by the time we reach our early 20s, our brain development is pretty much done and our character is pretty much set. It can still be improved later because the human brain is plastic. We can still learn things later, especially if we want to learn things later, but it becomes more difficult. It's kind of similar to playing a musical instrument, right? You
or
learn
learning
much
a, or learning a foreign
or learning
language.
A language. Exactly. Yeah. It can be done at any age, especially if you have the motivation. But it's certainly far easier when you're young because, you know, your brain is so much more receptive and so much more pliable. So why don't we teach virtue and character to our young kids? And as I was sort of thinking about this the other day, I went to see a movie called a documentary called Young Plato, which is set in Belfast. And it's about the principal of an elementary school trying to introduce philosophy, practical philosophy, to the kids. And it's fascinating because, first of all, they react in an incredibly positive fashion because he's not giving them, you know, metaphysics or, you know, abstract things or things that can understand. He's talking about bullying, he's talking about violence, he's talking about failure, he's talking about all sorts of stuff that they can relate to, the kids relate to. And there's the movie is just fascinating because you see the interaction between you know, the teacher and the kids in terms of teaching not, you know, math or literature or something like that, but teaching values and character. And guess what? The principal does try to use a range of philosophers, including some modern ones, but most of the time he keeps coming back to Socrates and the Stoics. There is an entire section in the documentary where which is about Seneca and anger, right? Because of course the kids are angry. They're angry at each other. They're sometimes angry at their parents, and you know, and they have to process that anger, and they're helped by Seneca. So the very notion that somebody who lived 2,000 years ago and certainly didn't write for children, you know, 2,000 years later is introduced in a classroom of, you know, 7 or 8, 9 years old, and these kids are actually responding to it. It's, to me, it's really amazing. But it raises the question of, you know, why don't we do that more broadly, more widely? And so typically there are two people that resist introducing ethics and other aspects of philosophy at a pre-college level. And these are politicians, local politicians especially, and parents, surprisingly. And I thought, wait, right, exactly. So why? And then there is a scene in the movie that made it very clear to me why. At some point, the principal is talking to his kids, and one of the kids said, you know, my parents keep telling me that the other side, you know, remember this is Belfast, right?
Yeah.
The other side is, you know, evil, and we need to beat him up, or, you know, something like that. And the principal looks at him and says, well, I'm going to teach you how to argue with your parents.
Oh no.
Right. So right. So that's why, of course, a lot of parents and politicians are not too happy about that sort of teaching, because that is questioning, you're teaching people, and among other things, to question authority. And authority, of course, usually doesn't like to be questioned. So that's what happens. But it's an incredibly positive example of how you can really do practical philosophy with kids. We're talking elementary school kids.
That does sound fascinating. I'd like to watch that. And I know that you mentioned right at the beginning that your interest in Stoicism and in this sort of virtue ethics more widely, but Stoicism in particular, arose through having a difficult time. So clearly, that suggests that you felt that that this type of philosophy was helpful to you on a, I mean, you know, I'm not suggesting you were sort of depressed or anxious, but that it was good for your mental equilibrium.
Yes,
let's
definitely.
Put it that way. And so do you feel there is a really strong crossover between this sort of philosophy and psychology in the sort of broad terms that we've been talking about?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the things that are happening in psychology recently is that a number of psychologists are moving away from the model of psychology being focused only on pathologies. Right. So, yeah, there are pathologies. There certainly are human pathologies of the body is just as much as of the mind. But in the same way in which a healthy body is a question mostly of maintenance, it's a question of prevention. And you want to make, you know, a right to the intervention only as the last resort. You ideally want a good doctor would want his patients not to ever have to go to the doctor, right? Mm. You want them to exercise, you want to eat healthy and all that, taking care of their body, because that's the best way to live a healthy life. Similarly, I would think a good psychologist wouldn't want to have only people who are clinically depressed or anxious or anything like that. What you want is to teach people how not to get to that point, how to live a psychologically healthy, in a healthy fashion. And if you start doing that, then you're very close to philosophy at that point, right? Because then you have to ask yourself, well, what is a psychologically healthy life for a human being? How do we actually teach people that sort of thing? And now you can help yourself as a psychologist, not just to modern empirical evidence, which there is quite a bit about, you know, character and about behavior in general, so healthy behavior in general, but you can help yourself to literally 2.5 millennia of philosophical thought.
And that leads me to think that, you know, as we might say, you know, a healthy mind in a healthy body, could we say healthy individuals in a healthy society, and consider that, you know, the more healthy individuals there are in these sort of broad terms that we're talking about, then, you know, then you have a society with substantially less toxic aspects. And this swings us back to the focus of the book with leaders, that then you might be able to actually elect people who aren't traumatized and wounded, because you might have that healthier society. But do you think that there is this, there is, you know, we've expanded the idea of mental wellness beyond not the absence of pathology, but also to expand the idea of mental wellness from the individual to a much broader context?
Yes. And that, of course, is very challenging, because now you're talking about, if we're talking about structure in society, like, let's say, systemic racism, for instance, systemic sexism, then now you're talking about something that, of course, an individual can do relatively little about, or even a philosopher or a psychologist can do very little about. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean it's not important to address. And I do find that in that area, in the when it comes to structural issues, some of the Greco-Roman philosophies tend to be deficient because they're not focused on that at all. Like, for instance, Stoicism. For a Stoic, the kind of society in which you live, the kind of government that you have, you know, that so on and so forth, those are only preferred or dispreferred indifference, as they say. In other words, it doesn't affect your character. You know, yeah, you find yourself under tyranny or autocracy. Well, that's too bad. There's not much you can do about it. Now you need to cope with it. Now you need to figure out how to cope with it. Now, that's important. Coping is important. And I think actually that some modern commentators, some modern authors emphasize too much the structural level and too little the personal level. They say, oh, we need to change society. Yes, we do. But what are we going to do in the meantime? You also need to teach people to cope with whatever situation they face, because it is not in their power usually to change the situation to that extent. The two things are not mutually exclusive, in other words. We should really be working in both levels. And too often I hear them presented as if they were
alternatives.
Oh, you either do that. No, why would that be the case? Why should I stop working on my own resilience to a situation that I don't like, and at the same time work toward changing the situation itself, right? That's not. Now, there are some ancient commentators, and again, I go back to Cicero here, that were aware of this. Cicero wrote on duties, as I said earlier, in terms of personal duties. It's one of those treatises that it's not very different from a Stoic text. So it's about you as an individual and how you function in whatever society you're given. But then he also wrote De Republica, which was his response to Plato's Republic, where he talks about how we should structure a fair and just state. So you got both. Mm-hmm. And of course, you got both precisely because Cicero was that kind of unusual person who was both a politician and a philosopher, right? So he was very aware from a philosophical perspective. He was aware that you do need to work on your resilience and acceptance of things, because there are some things you cannot change. But as a politician, he was also interested in changing things, right? In making society a better place for everybody. And I think that those two things really are not only they're not mutually exclusive, they're actually self-reinforcing. They're mutually reinforcing.
So how are we going to get these leaders that aren't like Alcibiades, the leaders who, and where are the Socrateses that are going to be guiding them? I guess we kind of have to hope that these people come out of the future readership of your book.
Yes, you would. But, well, ultimately in the book, I guess in some respect, come to the conclusion that it's our own damn fault, because at least in democratic or more or less democratic societies, after all, we are the people who put those leaders in charge, right? I mean, it's always fun to complain about politicians in the United States are seen by the public as almost the lowest level of society in terms of trustworthiness.
They're
right?
Not doing much better here, actually.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's like, poll after poll shows that, politicians are all the way down, they're barely above the level of murderers and rapists. And yet you would say, well, but who elects those people? We do, right? I mean, if we're talking about an autocratic country, let's say Russia, that's a different issue. People don't have a lot of a choice there. But we do. More or less, because, of course, I tend to think, for instance, as of the United States, more as an oligarchy at this point.
Oh, yes, I think you're right.
Than as a democracy. But nevertheless, there is sufficient democratic input that at the end of the day, we are the ones that are responsible. And so we are now coming full circle. That's why the quest for character is important. It's not just important for politicians. It's important for us. If we don't improve our own character, if we don't start paying attention to people of good character and start pushing those people, like Socrates did in Athens, to run for as statesmen, and conversely, if we don't start pushing people that shouldn't be politicians away, then we get what we deserve. It comes down to that.
so if we should sort of go back to what I was saying, Gabor Mate's idea that the traumatized are electing the traumatized and the wounded are electing the wounded, if we can work through our own areas of wounds and our own areas of trauma and our own areas of poor character, then we're in a better position to elect those who are not traumatized, those who are not wounded, and those who have the kind of character that we want.
Correct. And I think one important way of doing that is to get psychologists and philosophers, in the sense of practical philosophers, to work with people, because that's how you convince people that they need to take care of their mental health. And mental health includes character, includes working on your views of the world, your priorities, your behavior, et cetera, et cetera.
Wonderful. I think that's an inspiring rally call. Are there any other aspects from the book or more generally that we haven't addressed that you'd really like people to know, Massimo?
Well, the last chapter in the book, which is mostly about the modern evidence, so most of the book is about the ancient Greco-Roman examples because they're fascinating and they're you know historically interesting. But in the end, the book does come to modern times and to modern science because you know we live in the 21st century. And so, what I would like to remind people is that there is very clear evidence of what works and what doesn't work in order to improve our character. And so don't do the things that don't work and try to do the things that do work. For instance, you know, just let me give you one example of each. One thing that doesn't work, for instance, is virtue labeling. You know, we're told to tell our kids that they're brilliant, that they'll succeed, even though they're clearly not brilliant and they probably won't succeed. And there's pretty good evidence that that's just not going to improve things. You may boost self-confidence, but if that self-confidence is actually not based on a substance, it's not based on something that comes from the inside, in the long run, it's not going to do any good. In fact, it is damaging. Yeah, it's fragile. It becomes, you know, it's damaging. So that's one thing that doesn't work. So don't do it. One thing that does work is to engage in sustained self-analysis. So the classic example is philosophical journals like Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, for instance. Right. The notion there is spend some time, ideally every day, but at least several times a week, just a few minutes before you go to bed, sit down for your computer or open a, you know, God forbid, open an actual diary made of, you know, paper and pick up a pen and write down your thoughts about something that has happened during the day that has valence in terms of ethics and character. And ask yourself three questions. What did I do wrong? What did I do right? And what could I do better next time? The first question, what I did wrong, it's not because you want to punish yourself for indulging regret or anything. Those are completely useless things. It's because you want to learn from your experiences. Right. So, today I reacted, you know, I got angry with a colleague, for instance. Well, that was not a good reaction. So let me pay attention to that. The second question, what did I do right? Is because you want to keep track of those things that what you get right as well, because ultimately what you want is to move away as much as possible from the not good stuff, not good behavior, and as much as possible toward the good behavior. So you want those points of reference. The third question is arguably the most important one. That is, what could I do better next time? Situations will recur. We go to work every day. We see the same people. We encounter very similar situations. Then at home, we come back home every night and we see the same people. We encounter similar situations. We go on vacations or we go and have a weekend. We see the same people and we encounter similar situations. So if you make a mistake once, you get upset or angry or you yell at somebody, and then you reflect on it and say, okay, next time that I see something like this developing, here's what I'm going to do. You are preparing your mind for a better response. And a mind prepared goes a long way toward actually responding better the next time. And the more you do respond better, the more that becomes a habit and therefore your character has improved.
And actually, I've got the book that we published a couple of years ago, which has got those kind of exercises in it. And I I did them, and I have to say, I have to say, it has actually worked because I hope my father isn't listening. My dad phones me every night. I had a bad accident about 10 years ago, and he used to phone me every night because when I came out of the hospital, I was very weak, and so he was phoning me every night. And we hadn't had that kind of contact for a long time, but you know, he was checking I hadn't died. And as time moved on and I was getting better, I said to him, oh, are you just going to stop phoning me now? Oh, there it is. It's over there. Bit like a stoic. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you going to stop phoning me? And he said, no, I'll carry on phoning you. So he has been phoning me at 6:45 every evening for the last 10 years. unless
Right.
I've been working abroad or, you know, but
Sure.
basically pretty much every night. So, of course, you know, we have nothing to say to each other. And, you know, your dad can be really annoying. And your dad has these stupid jokes that he insists on saying to you every single time. I used to go to yoga on Tuesday nights and, oh, are you off to yogurt? And I used to want to throttle, you know, but I find I can, I don't, for a while, I was just doing the kind of like, yeah, okay. And after a while, that habit became, you know, and I the sort of like smiling and the gentleness, and I remembered how much I love him and how much I'm grateful for him, however, you know, annoying those prompts would have been to me. So there
That's
you
right.
have it. It
Interesting.
works.
It works. Yeah. There's pretty good evidence it works, and you are yet another piece of evidence that it does work.
Thank you so much. Is there anywhere online that people should look out for you and follow up and just remind people of the title of this book and any other information that you'd like people to be
Yeah,
able to seek out?
so people can find me online at massimopiliucci.org. So you find everything there, all my essays and podcasts and videos and all that sort of stuff. And as far as the book is concerned, is The Quest for Character in the UK and parts of Europe is going to be published, is published already as How to Be Good.
Wonderful. Well, be good. And if you can't, be clever. Is
Yeah, that's the
that
idea.
right? Take care. And take care. And thank you so much
Thank you.
for another fascinating interview on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Massimo Piliucci is such a great speaker, so passionate and clear in his delivery. And what he has to say is fascinating. I was a little concerned that we were too far away from the core areas which Shrink Wrap Radio covers, but I think it's evident from the conversation that philosophy, politics, and psychology are more intertwined than we tend to think. It's the modern trend, particularly in academia, to balkanize subjects into distinct disciplines. But to misquote the conservationist John Muir, you pull one strand and everything else comes along with it. Where we have a wounding social system, we, the wounded, elect wounded politicians who make the social system yet more damaging, and it's a vicious cycle. I do believe that structural change and personal development are necessary. We won't get one without the other. But I worry and wonder if we have the time to exert sufficient pressure to turn a vicious cycle into a virtuous one. I mention that because there's another element to good character, I believe, which is urgently required. As well as the pro-social traits, we need pro-environmental ones. And I wonder how a consideration of the virtues of various Indigenous peoples would further expand the concept of well-being, from individual to social to planetary. My story at the end is entirely true, and I'd forgotten about it until I was speaking with Massimo. It's encouraged me to carry out further regular self-questioning. I do hope you found the interview useful as well as interesting. And you can find more information on Professor Piliucci in the show notes connected to this episode. Thanks to Dr. Dave for letting me pursue my curiosity via conversation once again. You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.